G'day listeners, welcome to another episode in our ongoing India Now series. And for reasons that will become obvious later, I'm going to begin by telling you a Gough Whitlam story. Malcolm Farr wrote this on the occasion of Whitlam's death. There will be seemingly endless stories today about how Whitlam reshaped Australia, but little mention of perhaps his first great achievement, indoor plumbing. In 1965, 45% of Australians lived in homes which were not connected to the sewerage system, and most of them were in the outer suburbs. Whitlam insisted the Commonwealth help resolve the many problems of the swollen new suburbs of the capital cities, and that included the mission to bring the humble toilet inside. As the late Neville Wran recalled, it was said of Caesar Augustus that he found Rome brick and left it marble. It will be said of Gough Whitlam that he found the outer suburbs of Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane unsewered and left them fully flushed. Okay, why am I telling you this? Well, politics is rarely linked to the issue of sanitation and flushing toilets. And a little far more recently than Gough's initiatives, something happened in India. We talked about it in 2014. It was when Prime Minister Narendra Modi made a promise to clean up the country's public spaces and, yes, put a toilet in every household. A bold promise. India's cities, rivers and streets are choked with litter of every kind. Open defecation remains a widespread practice, but Modi's bid to sweep away the dirt faces several complicating social and cultural factors. As authors Asa Doran and Robin Jeffrey argue in their new book, Waste of a Nation, Garbage and Growth in India, the stigmas attached to those who deal with waste are an obstacle in the country's sustainable future. Waste of a Nation offers an historical and anthropological account of India's relationship with garbage, and I'm delighted to have both authors as my guests. Asa Doran is on the Blower from Canberra, and Robin Jeffrey, is here in the Sydney studio. Welcome back to both of you. Asa, in your opening chapter, you quote a bloke who says, why is India so filthy? Well, can you give us a quick sketch of the scale of the problem? How filthy is it?
Well, you know, India, as Arthur Koestler, when he came to India in the 1960s, said when he left the airport in Mumbai, he said, I feel like I'm covered with a wet nappy. It is a place that has really stimulated a lot of reactions from people who visited. Some people, when I met in India, said they can't believe the amount of filth that they see on the street, the smells, the odors, the people who are beggars, the waste collectors. And the scale is enormous when India accelerated since the 1990s and came into the world, if you will, and began following suit of the Western world and engaging in, you know, consumer behavior.
I can suddenly see futile efforts at street sweeping. Almost everywhere you go in India, there's someone with a beautifully handmade broom shifting the dust 1 foot to the left or 1 foot to the right. And, of course, the so-called sacred cows graze on the garbage. How they survive, I cannot imagine. And so you actually asked Modi why he'd chosen Clean India as the centrepiece of his campaign. What did he say to you?
I think Modi's main concern was he himself experienced this problem of waste, this crisis of waste, and when he was in 1979 in the Morbi collapse, the dam collapse, where thousands of people perished and disease flourished in the area, and he wanted to stop that and clean the area and manage the waste and sanitation and floods that came alongside them. Two decades later, he spoke about the plague that hit Surat in Gujarat. Actually, I was in India at the time, and I recall my wife and I, the airports were closed. People were using incense in order to try and clear the air of what was thought to be a bubonic plague or some kind of plague. In the end, we know that it wasn't that. But India was very much isolated from the world. And Modi was then a very high in the RSS, which is a Hindu organization, and he came to Surat and tried again to mitigate the problem that people realized Surat was one of the dirtiest places in India 3 years later.
I know he made the point that open defecation is a particular problem for women who are, well, forced to endure indignity at best, harassment, rape, etc., because they have to go out in the dark, unprotected, to relieve themselves.
Indeed. And what we found, which was kind of counterintuitive, is that even when you place those toilets in the homes of women in rural areas and other places, they wouldn't use them because many of these women will then have to lug the water another 2-4 kilometers a day in order to clean the toilets. And many of the women find respite in actually leaving the household and the in-laws' place and going to gossip with other women. When they go and defecate or urinate, they have that space. They even use their mobile phones when they're away from this, you know, supervising eye of the family. So it's not... Plonking toilets is not the solution. It needs to be far more effective and culturally sensitive in understanding of how and why people should use toilets, like exactly like they educated people why they should take up their mobile phones. There's over almost 2 billion mobile phones now in India.
And that reminds me of the fact, Robin, that when you were last on the program, it was mobile phones we were discussing, the transformational impact.
Well, I think that's the hopeful sign in the whole notion that you can create a cleaner India, that there's been a terrific change in communication in the last 15 years, an amazing kind of transformation in the way in which people are able to link with others for political purposes. Now, often this can be for bad reasons, but it also means that people previously without any kind of recourse to higher authority now can communicate through various means. We were talking earlier, Philip, about the fact that you might even, in a sense, skip the literacy stage.
This is a conversation we were having off air because when the program was last in India 20 years ago and I was looking at the spaghetti of cables, I wrote about it. I said, look, India, if it gets the mobile phone technology, can not only unscramble the skies, but they could leapfrog over traditional literacy notions.
Very much. And if you get the kinds of transformations that the mobile phone has brought in the way people communicate and experience entertainment, anything is possible. And of course, this kind of technology is part of the campaign the government is waging for the cleaner India.
I'm talking to Robin Jeffrey, Emeritus Professor at La Trobe, and to Asadorna, who's Associate Professor and Research Fellow in Anthropology at the ANU. Okay, Robin, you point out that one of the obstacles a Clean India campaign faces is the clash between religion and science. How does that clash manifest?
Well, I think it manifests itself in the form of caste, that there is a shared belief if you are a particularly orthodox person born into a Hindu tradition that some people carry pollution with them, that they are somehow tainted.
And isn't it an irony that if you visit the Ganges at Varanasi, here are people bathing in this open sewer, cleaning their teeth in it,
yeah,
and yet they won't accept food that's been prepared by a Dalit?
Well, or even food that's prepared by someone that might be a little bit suspect. But as you say, the Ganga carries no pollution. The Ganga is a purificatory river.
Okay, so this is the big issue in your view, the caste issue.
Caste is one of the two unique elements, in my view, that make India's problems with the waste that we all experience as urbanizing middle-class societies and growing societies, with our populations growing in the case of India. But volume is huge. India has a density of population that's really unequaled by any other country in the world for the size of the country. And, of course, caste is the other element in this.
Well, one of the other problems is that in the West we associate environmental problems with a consumerist throwaway culture. But you and Asa note that India joined that culture relatively late.
Yes, and it joined after many, many years of frugality. Now, perhaps all rural societies were frugal, but India was particularly frugal. The whole, again, this is one of the very positive sides of Hinduism, the notion that austerity is a virtuous thing, and that at the end of your life, if you're living a good life, the final stage is to become very austere and get rid of all foolish fripperies of material life.
I well remember the way Indians would use leaves to wrap food, or they'd brush their teeth with neem twigs, and in fact often serve food in the most beautiful little terracotta bowls, which were then thrown away. But of course terracotta is hardly a pollutant. It was almost a charming culture.
Yeah, there was an interesting experiment about 15, 20 years ago when the railways minister said we'll serve all the drinks on the Indian railways with clay bowls, but it didn't last very long, and it took a lot of labour to make all those little clay cups for Indian railways.
Who collects garbage in India at the moment, Robin, before we go back to Asra? I understand the rag and bone men are still available.
Well, the kabariwala is the Indian equivalent. And, of course, the kabariwala is a great figure. Anyone over 30 has a wonderful kabariwala story about how the kabari would come and your mother would be waiting for him to pounce on him with newspapers accumulated over the previous 2 or 3 weeks, and then would haggle with him about how much he was going to pay for those newspapers. And the kabariwala tradition is still there. And this is one of the other pluses that India has in dealing with or attempting a cleaning up of India, that it has this tradition of recycling. India was recycling long before the term was coined, and that's a great advantage to be built on, and is being built on in some parts of India.
Asra, tell me about manual scavenging, as it's euphemistically called.
Well, these are people who actually go, they're very poor, whether they're Dalits or poor Muslims or people who are coming into the cities and they don't have any other line of work. And this is a very easy way to get some meager income. And they go around the street and they pick whatever rubbish is thrown away. And I mean, I was really surprised when I was walking with them and looking at what they collect. At one point, after about a few hours of collecting rubbish, they unpacked their bag, and I could see them scrambling in it and taking whether it was shoes or henna bottles or cassette tapes, and they were picking up hair. And I was thinking, what is this hair that they're picking and putting in this little place beside them? And I realized that actually the hair that they collect and they pry from the recycled material that they scavenge along the way is quite valuable. And they accumulate it over a couple of weeks, and then they sell this waste hair. The women brush, Indian women brush, they even recycle that, and they sell it to another person in the chain.
I understand that at the end of the chain, the finished hair is sent off overseas where it's used for wigs, but some hair has more value than others. You tell us that it's more valuable if it's from young people or if it's temple hair.
Yes, well, the temple hair is probably the most famous one. It's very lucrative. It's a multi-million dollar business. And it's because of life cycle and various rituals that women go to in South India in the temples. And over there, their hair is shaved and there's a legion of barbers who clean up the hair, and then they auction the hair. The temple auctions the hair and to the highest bidder. And it's a multi-million dollar business. In the end, as you said, it reaches the high streets of London, or Africa is a big consumer of temple hair. But what was remarkable about what we found is that we're not talking about temple hair, we're talking about waste hair. The hair that women every day when they do their, let's say, everyday rituals of brushing, that they chuck away. And that hair is even valuable. And the person that we met, who actually is at the top of that recycling chair, told us that he exports 60 metric tons of waste hair every month. And I went to his factory, he had a Mercedes. He was the self-styled king of hair. And it was like any other capitalist factory. And when I asked him, how many people do you employ? And he said, oh, hundreds of thousands. Of course, he didn't mean hundreds of thousands. These are the manual scavengers. And through the chain, they feed the waste hair into his factory, where people comb it and brush it and shampoo it and clean it. And then it's exported to different areas in the world.
Okay, Robin, let's go back to shit. We've got to deal with this. Tell us about the sewer divers.
Well, Assi encountered the people who clean sewers in Australia, as you probably know, or people who have ever watched them. They go down into sewers with lines on them with oxygen. They wear the equivalent of a deep sea diver's suit. The sewer diving in India, the same tasks of cleaning sewers, going underground to remove blockages, is done by chaps who go down in a pair of shorts. And if they've just had a good haircut from the barber, they might put a plastic bag on their head to keep their hair nice. But no, it's a constant source of scandal. There have been hundreds of deaths in the last few years of people going down the drains and not coming back because they get hit by the methane and other poisonous gases that accumulate in sewers, just as we know in countries that send sewer divers down in diver suits rather than in knickers and a plastic bag.
One of the chapters in the book, Asa, deals with the question of what waste has value. Okay, the enormous trade in human hair. What are some of the others that you've discovered?
Well, actually, the beginning of the book itself, the beginning of the project was because of our mobile phone book that Robin and I wrote, and we realized that in these gray markets, there's thousands and thousands of mobile phones that after they go through various incarnations and their valuable materials are going to other phones, these phones end up as e-waste or electronic waste. And tracing that to see where this e-waste ends up in these bylanes of various slums, we realized that there's a huge industry of electronic waste. Other forms of waste is, of course, medical waste. And the popular ones that we know about is plastics and other forms of white goods that reach India from overseas. There's a lot of smuggling of waste or exporting of waste from so-called first world countries to India, which arrives by various illicit processes or trajectories. And that ends up, again, in the informal economy.
Robin, when you entered the building tonight to have this chat, you would have been very close to a bin in which we at the ABC are asked to toss old mobile phones. I've never thought of where they're heading. So a lot of those would finish up in India.
In India and until recently, of course, in China, where the labour is there. There is a factory in Singapore that takes them apart. There may be plants in Australia that actually dismantle them, but they do have to be dismantled because the metal materials that have most value, of course, are bonded by heat into the plastic that is the outer casing of your phone. That's what really got Assi when we first got interested in this. He went to a colony when we were working on the mobile phones and saw little boys cooking mobile phones in saucepans over single flame burners in order to melt the plastic so you could pull out the metal components, which was where the value lay.
Let's walk back to Modi and his toilets, because I remember in 2014 we were very enthusiastic on this program. It seemed to be a very bold initiative. Let's look at some of the issues, Robin, because one of the things, of course, is water. It must take vast amount of water to flush toilets. Where is the water coming from?
Well, of course, the toilets, if you go into the website of these Clean India Mission, you'll see that there's a ticker that tells you how many million toilets have been built. We're up, I think, to about 62 million new toilets. Now, these are mostly dry latrines, the kind that rural Australians would understand. At their most primitive, they're the dunny with the brown snake and the red back under the seat waiting for you in the middle of the night. And that's part of the reluctance in India, that these standalones have to be maintained and kept clean. That job does fall invariably to women. That's part of the difficulty. And of course, they have to be properly built. Even the old Australian dunny had to be a certain depth. The models that are available, the two-pit latrine, which is popular, requires one pit to be cleaned out every couple of years. Now, who's going to clean that pit? Well, in the old days, you would have whistled up the local untouchables in the village. But today, those people are much less reluctant. partly because of mobile phones, that they have rights and they're not keen on doing that kind of work. So who's going to clean them? And eventually you end up with two pits filled. And if the pits aren't dug deep enough, you've got a problem. So part of the problem with the toilet building campaign is the water one, and that no Indian city now is likely ever to be sewered in the way that is required and requires, of course, so much water.
Okay, now India has a huge air pollution problem. Mm-hmm. Delhi now makes, well, it makes China, it makes it makes Beijing look almost fresh. Mm. A crisis like this, does this focus the Indian political mind wonderfully?
You'd like to think so. We have a hypothesis in the book that there is something called a binding crisis, where it's so awful for everybody, rich and poor alike, that action follows. It hasn't followed yet in the case of air pollution in Delhi. We'd like to think that if the awareness of the harm that open defecation and poor sanitation does to young children of the rich as well as the poor, if that becomes more commonly known, there'll be more concerted action involving all classes to do something about it. Just, I mean, the London sewers resulted from the great stink of 1858, when the Thames was so awful, Parliament really couldn't meet, so passed legislation just so they could go home. And the sewerage that was built in London in the 1860s was partly a result of that terrible notion, but it improved the health of the poor as well as the rich.
Is there some hope in the number of NGOs and crisis groups that flourish in India, Robert?
We'd like to think so, but somebody like me has been putting my hope in those wonderful local groups for 35 years now. It's very hard to bring them together nationally, to bring something national out of this wonderful social energy that may get things done in a patchwork way around the country. So I think there is hope, but it lies in taking the best ideas of some of these groups and trying to grow them in other places.
And so India isn't monolithic. It's the most complicated and vast society. Are there parts of India, perhaps Kerala, who do things better?
Well, I think Kerala is doing things better, first and foremost, because it has a very high literacy rate and the education levels are the highest in India. So there
is more. Used to be run by communists, I recall.
Indeed. So there's certainly more awareness about waste and sanitation, and in fact, also regulation. So when I was in Kerala, what I found is the majority of the rubbish in Kerala is exported to the adjacent state of Tamil Nadu, where it is not as so-called developed as Kerala. And so you get in Tamil Nadu, you get all the, they're offshoring their waste to the poorer state besides them.
Shifting waste around the place is also done in a huge scale in Australia. Many of those dumpsters are loaded into great big trucks and shunted up to Queensland. I mean, we're all good, not in our backyard attitude.
Exactly.
So we shove the rubbish around. Robin, are you optimistic? You love India.
I suppose I'm always glass half full and half empty at the same time. Good things are happening. There's never been a government and a prime minister who has put so much energy into the whole notion of public health and public sanitation. Now, whether that energy is being well spent, the problem is that the campaign so far has been terribly target-driven and top-down. And where the successes come from, they bubble up from the bottom, seeking aid from the top, seeking money, seeking expertise. But the rewards aren't forthcoming to the people actually doing some of the most exciting work at the patchwork level around the country.
They need to bring Gough back. He would be a huge help at this moment of crisis. Look, thank you both, gentlemen. Asa Doran, Associate Professor and a Research Fellow in Anthropology at ANU, and Robin Jeffrey, Emeritus Professor at La Trobe University in Melbourne and at the ANU. And Robin, thanks for all your backstage work in helping or trying to help to get Late Night Live to India. The book is called Waste of a Nation, Garbage and Growth in India, and it's published this month by, of all things, Harvard University Press. Good on you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks, Philip.